Hello and welcome to 92.6 FM. This is Verum Sports Weekly Sporting Debate. And always, the topic of our debate is chosen by you, the listeners. So thank you for getting involved. And as always, it's your show every bit as much as it is ours. So continue to stay involved. And my goodness me, they've given us a doozy this week. I'm excited for this one. It's so broad and so many myriad angles that we can take this. But thank you to the listeners this week, myself and the legendary machine, Jason McKenna, are going to unpack, debate, dissect and analyse the impact, both positive and negative, of the fusion of sport and economics. So many different layers to this. And I know, my goodness me, I just know you've got your views. You'd love those glorious days of times gone past where, my goodness me, politicians never lied. It was constantly sunny and blighty and, you know, it was potpourri all over. I'm talking about the amateur era where everything was grand. I know some of you love that, but I'm sure some of you will understand the importance of earning a living at what you're good at and have that view too. Whatever your views are, you are entitled to them, but more importantly, I want to hear them. Continue to tweet us at Verum Sport. Remain engaged. But now it is befitting and indeed incumbent on me to introduce tonight the legendary machine, Jason McKenna. Good evening, Jason. How are you?
I'm good, Tony. Just, you know, I always look forward to this part of my week. We always get stuck into a discussion which matters to the people of St. Albans as well. You know, they've been choosing on social media and emailing in as well. Now, we do have a lot to discuss from social media, and a lot of people message in about COVID. How's that going to affect the sport? And we will probably cover it, but I think, you know, I don't need to mention that one too much in the start there because I think that goes without saying. But we do have other messages. Tina has put a very important question here, I think, that when will women's sport get more money and coverage like men's? Michael has sent in, I don't know if it's controversial, I think a lot of people actually agree with it, but footballers are paid too much. Now, that's something that I definitely disagree with, and Tony, I think we'll discuss that a little bit later. But the final one, and I think this is something that you can definitely lend your knowledge about, Richard has said, will rugby ever be on the same level as football in terms of finances and TV time? So I think, you know, we've got to discuss Tina, Michael and Richard's points, but I think start with the last one there, the rugby one, because I'm not too knowledgeable. Will rugby ever reach that stratospheric level?
It's a good question. Look, I'm of the mindset that in a sort of an infinite timeline, that there is infinite possibilities. And as a consequence of that, kind of framing it so broadly as I've done there, the answer's entirely yes. Of course, it could well become that. But setting that aside, in the realm of sort of a normal human lifespan and what I like to consider, quote unquote, the common sense real, you know, look, it's quite frankly highly, highly unlikely. And thus, I'm actually going to say no. I'm afraid it's almost like comparing apple and pear. They're different sports with a different audience base, and that's always going to be the case. Too many massive, massive things would have to change. Look, I mean, look, for goodness sake, when England won the World Cup, people got behind it, and it, you know, it had that kind of connection, which was marvelous. But still, you look at, you know, the TV ratings, et cetera, et cetera, and they pale. They literally pale into insignificance. Football here, and indeed for the majority of the world, is the preeminent sport. Okay, it's not my place to debate the whys and wherefores of that or the relative merits of it. It's irrelevant. It's a fact. And based on that, I simply cannot envisage a world that I'm living in where rugby has anything close to parity to the exposure, to the financial prospects of football. I simply can't envisage it for the reasons that I've tried to explain there. Great question, though.
And what about with the others then? So I think combating Tina's, you know, when will women's sport get the same money in coverage. It's just an unfortunate kind of thing in society at the moment. I think generally women's efforts aren't as valued as men's, and I think, you know, there's got to be a societal shift to actually evaluate and treat women fairly, basically. So I think hopefully in my lifetime we do see a shift towards that, and then hopefully more money and coverages come towards female sport. But I think also we have seen recently some really positive trends. You know, the women's last Football World Cup was absolutely, you know, stellar. I think at the Olympics you've seen people like Jessica Ennis really kind of lift it, and also you see people like Serena Williams, who arguably, you know, can go toe to toe with anybody in history of tennis. So I'm positive, I'm hopeful, and maybe kind of with the question of rugby, you know, will it ever be on the same level as men? Women, I can't see why not. You know, these are athletes, these are people at the top of their game. I don't see why not. I mean, can you add anything to that, Tony?
I'm going to slightly advocate the devil here. Okay, and I always bang the drum for the female sports, and I would like to kind of predicate this piece by saying I think there has been such important strides forward. As you say, that's last Football World Cup from the female perspective. So many eyeballs were enthralled by England getting to the semi-finals, losing to the eventual champions, the USA. The progress across the board is massive, and I think that is so, so important. And I think for me, the critical thing is equality of opportunity. And that is something I'm a massive advocate for. But do I think that there should be parity of pay in much the same way as I think we're comparing apples and pears when it comes to rugby and football? In a utopia, then maybe there's everything should just be on the sort of some standardized thrust of or flow of money, maybe. But my point is, look, in a tennis context, for instance, Serena Williams, I'm on record, I'm a massive advocate. I think she's one of the greatest athletes ever to grace planet Earth. But female tennis stars in Grand Slam will only play across essentially the first of three or best of five sets. Should they then therefore have the same wage as or earnings? And I think it is actually in tennis very close, if not indeed actually already equal. But the men, of course, play across five. In rugby, the female world, they're only just recently full-time pros, and the standard is ever improving, and that across the board of all female sports. But in terms of their abilities, there may be some superstars, but I would still say generally there will be a disparity in the overarching qualities from the male and female side of things. So my advocating the devil line on this one is I don't actually think there is a need for equality. I don't necessarily think men and women in sports are per se equal. However, what I would massively advocate, always have done, always will do, is there had ought to be an improved prospect of equality, of earning capacity. So in much the same way as all sporting stars, and we'll come to this one, in my humble opinion, earn every single penny that they are able to get. I think there needs to be ever improved exposure, which of course then creates a kind of snowball whereby, again, that inspires the next generation who look to move the bar. The bar gets ever raised. We raise the momentum. That, I think, is vital. Accordingly, I think all female superstars, those who transcend their sports, should have the same brand building opportunity as, to use the sort of apotheosis of this, a David Beckham, for instance. That's critical. I don't think we're even close to that level yet. But just coming back to my point, because of the fundamental physical difficulties, because of the nature of the cultures, I would suggest, obviously, it's worlds apart. We're talking gender here, not form. But I think it's very similar to how rugby and football will never be on a par. And neither do I think, even as a rugby man, do they necessarily need to be. They're distinct. And that's my perspective on it. I'll tell you what, slightly controversial. I hope people appreciate the underlying thrust of that. If you want to take me up on this, though, please do get involved. We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Verum Sport, your views on the economic spread and the fairness of economic spread in many and women's sport disparity. Jason, your take on what I've hoped I've communicated there, my perspective merely.
Maybe I'm too utopian, too positive, but I feel like agreeing with your point there, if there's equality of opportunity, then the sky's the limit. You know, to Tini there's the potential if it's allowed. I think it's a societal problem that women's work isn't valued, and maybe if it does get more valued, then that could happen. So I think, you know, we're both singing off the same hymn sheet that we want equality of opportunity, and then hopefully there'll be equality in possibly outcome. So we shall see with that. But kind of moving on then to the final point there with Michael, footballers are paid too much. I think you've already said that there, Tony, that, you know, people should basically be allowed to earn what they want, because it's a market system at the end of the day. They do exquisite work. You know, not many people can do it. If you look at the best actors around the world, they probably earn more than footballers. You know, hundreds of millions for films, depending how long they are for. The weekly wage of an actor could far surpass that of a professional footballer. But people aren't talking about that. So I think it's easy to go against the footballers. They're seen as, you know, dramatic and things like that. But I think footballers, if they can earn it, why shouldn't they?
Totally, totally agree. And, you know, my two pennies on this, and I think you've really kind of dissected that nicely, is this. People say this to me all the time. And you know, the question in social media was football specific. But for me, this is sports stars, whether that's athletics, rugby, tennis, cricket, you name it. And obviously footballers these days, you know, Ronaldo is up there with Mayweather in terms of branding and all that stuff. For me, number one, the sacrifices these stars have made is astonishing. Okay. If you think of the sort of lifestyle that most adolescents lead, they've not had that life. You know, they've had to give up socializing to a strong degree. I'm not saying these guys are monks, you know, clearly that would be laying it on a little bit thick, but the sacrifices are supreme. The commitment, and you use the word, their art, but it's also crafted. The hours of training, of honing their skills, their talent in whatever form it takes, is truly, truly astonishing. And also, they inspire, Jason. This is one of the things that you and I love about sport, and I know you listening feel it too. When you witness a sporting piece of finesse, or just that transcendental moment, whatever it might be, I call it sporting theatre, whatever you want to call it, right? It hits a spark, it resonates, and it kind of connects on a level that reminds us exactly what we as a species, a human species, are indeed capable of achieving. And that's one of the overarching reasons why I am such a massive lover of sport. Now, not only those sacrifices, not only the commitment to their talent, you broke it down supremely well, Jason. People say to me all the time, let's just use this illustration of footballers. Oh, Tony, footballers are so overpaid. Now, just don't get anywhere near enough. Stop comparing apples and pears. Okay, it's nonsense. Nurses, I respect, and obviously this situation we're living in at the moment, thankfully, in a way, has drawn into attention our focus on these key workers, teachers, and all these kind of wonderful people, but their vocations. They knew the economic scenario of this calling, nurse or whatever, and they accept it. They're not per se money motivated accordingly, right? Now, the thing is, they are doing such a wonderful thing and so important things, nurses, doctors, what have you. But very rarely will they have that ability of an athlete or maybe, you know, an artist to truly kind of wow us, to astonish us, to make us realize just indeed what we can do. Okay. And accordingly, for me, Jason, they're entertainers, are sports stars. Ultimately, all the money and all the kind of other flow comes down to the fact that people have been wowed. They've been entertained. Okay. And as you say, if you play, compare it per capita versus, you know, the net earnings of, you know, even somebody astonishing like a Ronaldo or a David Beckham or whatever, versus, I don't know, just off the top of my head, a Tom Cruise, $30, $40 million for a movie which he shoots and it might take him 6 months maybe if there's problems. I mean, it's not even the same. If you are placing footballers and indeed sports stars in the proper category where I feel as though they richly deserve to belong, that of entertainers, I mean, I don't want to call them paupers, but my goodness me, in that entertainment context, no longer are they the sort of all-dominant, affluent players, really. And that's critical. That, for me, is my perspective. It's my view only. I know you echo it, but again, always want to hear from you. Are footballers just overpaid? Are athletes just, you know, minting it and maybe the money should be spread in these other more worthy places? Please engage with us. Love to hear from you. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. But Jason, I think on that one, you and I are certainly on the same hymn sheet. And another final point on this, and again, I think it's important because it sometimes is forgotten. An actor, for instance, a musician, can play into their 50s, 60s, 70s if they so desire. A sports star's career, whether it's football, cricket, golf, I don't care. Boom. One ACL tear, it's done. Okay, I know sports medicine's improving, thank goodness. But one major injury that could be done in training, man, it could be done getting out of bed. It's done. And that's the risk that so many people understand. And accordingly, for all those reasons, for me, athletes, sports stars, they deserve, they've earned every single penny, cent, dollar that they get. Just my views.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think the comparison there that you've made rightly, that it is more akin to entertainment than, you know, other kind of services there. But we've got some other great topics to talk about here. Should I move into my first point then, Tony? Because I want to bring up actually Brexit foreign players in the Premier League. I think we're going to see a very interesting economic shift post the exit of Britain from the European Union. Now, we're not talking about politics here. We're talking purely about sport. So yep. Under the current system, the Premier League, you can register 70 non-homegrown players in 25-man squads. But coming in and out of that, you've got like unlimited youngsters. So you can delve into those under-21s. But players from the European Economic Area, from Europe, can move freely, while those from the rest of the world have to have a very special but very, very stringent governing body endorsement from the FA, which is also administered by the government, and it's via a point system. Now, if I read out some of the rules, it seems very, very hard to get into. So it's to do with the amount of matches that you've played in the past 2 years in certain FIFA ranked. So if you're FIFA 1 to 10 clubs, you have to score 30% or above appearances, and moving it down, it kind of is more appearances for the lesser club that you appear for. Now, say if you're a pretty good, young, talented player, they say that they reduce it for ages under 21, but you still have to meet these requirements. It could be a diamond in the rough, somebody from South America, but if you don't have the dual nationality, it is so hard to enter European football. Now, you could point out to me that maybe Arsenal bought Gabriel Martinelli, a well-known Brazilian player. Well, he's got dual nationality with Italy. Players like Sergio Aguero have dual nationality with Spain. Some of the best South American or non-European talent is because they have a link to a European country, or for somebody like Mo Salah, he is always starting in that Egypt squad. But post-Brexit, these European players might be included in this government body endorsement. Now, kind of throwing the statistics to you, The Guardian recently reported that 65% of the Premier League's current players would not meet that GBA threshold. Now, think about how many European players that we have. 65% of them going. That would be astonishing. Now, this would filter down as well to the Championship, the Scottish Premiership. You know, we love talking about Brentford, the Bees. We've got Cliff Crown. The Brentford model,
Radlett's own,
might be absolutely destroyed because they go to European countries. They find little under-the-radar players. I'm talking about the likes of somebody, you know, like N'Golo Kante, Riyad Mahrez. They would not have met those values. So the problems are going to come in there if this is not addressed. And clubs have the application to kind of appeal this process. But Arsenal have a very, very famous case with a player called Joel Campbell. Now, obviously, I know it well because he was at my club. But it's a very good example. He joined from Costa Rica to Arsenal. However, he couldn't get the work permit, but he could in Spain. So Arsenal kept loaning him out. And he played very well in the World Cup, but the English government wouldn't allow him in. In the end, Arsenal couldn't integrate him into their squad, and they just had to let him go, which was a very sad thing because he was a great, talented player. I'm not sure what he's up to now, but this could become the more common case. Now, the positive side, which I'm sure you might tease out yourself, Tony, is the fact that more English young players will come through. But I'm thinking of the fact that the Premier League is viewed as one of the most open leagues in the world in terms of competition. You know, the fact that Jamie Vardy or, well, he's an English player, but, you know, moving it down through the league, there's some great foreign young talent that have come to the Premier League because of these amazing open borders. And now that they're likely to shut, this will cause a big problem for a lot of lower clubs down as well. Big clubs like Manchester United, Man City, Chelsea can buy these players of the high ranking. But if you move down, there's going to be a lot of reliance on young English talent. And the pool might not just be big enough. You know, Brighton might not be able to source loads of players from their area. And we know there's stringent rules about buying under 16s, under 18s. Yep. There are all these rules in place to rightly protect youngsters from being poached. But this could really, really damage English football. I'm not sure your feelings on this, Tony. Does this worry you?
I think it's one of those aspects that's kind of so much uncertainty at the moment, isn't there? And nobody quite knows from a business perspective where we will be. Again, want to keep it on the sporting plane. But it is an era of uncertainty. And the trouble with these big landmark historic moments a la the Brexit choice that we've made collectively as a nation is that there are so many ripples, and then the nature of ripples is that there are ripples within ripples, and so you can't necessarily foresee where things like what will be the impact on sports for Brexit be, when maybe the initial focus, probably quite prudently, will be, well, where are we going to trade? Where are we, you know, what's the logistics from in terms of crucial internal factors, trade, development, etc., etc.? But this is Verulam Sport. We love sports. And you've opened it up, Jason. I think you've made it very, very clear. This is a ripple that's going to keep on rippling. My initial gut reaction, it's just a gut reaction, is that always there are loopholes within loopholes. And I understand, obviously, your brilliant illustration that you've obviously felt quite poignantly from the Gunners' perspective shows that, you know, not every loophole is clean. And obviously, it proved to be untenable, that situation. But I do think that there will be a broad mindset that, for the reasons we've explained with regards to entertainment, for the reasons that on a brute economics level, the Premier League is a global factor. It has a massive importance economically for the UK. So I'm sure people that I'd rather hope are way smarter than you and I, and they're going to have these kind of conversations behind closed doors and be already plotting how to at least allow some type of flow from the international perspective of players in and out of the country. That's just my initial gut take on this. But it is such a aspect of our confusing world that's going to be fascinating to see how it really does unfold. Coming back to your point on the UK talent, I'm always a big fan of homegrown and developing that culture. But I think, for instance, one of the great imports from the Premier League, Chelsea's Gianfranco Zola, he made an amazing point years ago when he was at Napoli as a kid, when the all-time great Diego Maradona was a Napoli star, right? So essentially, you know, this young kid Zola wasn't getting a look in. But what he was looking at, because he's a smart person, was studying ROM, watching habits, getting like a sponge, knowledge, technique, training from this bona fide all-time great in Maradona. And Zola's on record as saying that that had such an important impact on him as a person, as a professional, and that's, you know, led to him having a very illustrious career. My point is this. I think, you know, the imports offer to our young talent that very opportunity. And I'm not always saying that that's embraced a la Zola. I think if it had been, frankly, I think England may well have had a little bit more silverware by now, quite to be blunt. But I like to think that this is an important aspect. But one of the things that I think is very crucial, I look at, the Borussia Dortmund star who potentially might be plying his trade in the Premier League next season. And I love that he went out there. I think young English talent should actually take a more diaspora kind of attitude and seek out a different culture, a different style of football on the continent or further afield. And I think that's something that we need to encourage and cultivate. And it's going to be interesting to see post-Brexit how that flow evolves. Jason, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I love the kind of shout there. And I think for me, I totally agree with you. I'm quite disappointed in the history or lack of history of British players going abroad to ply their trade, because plenty of them come to our country. I don't know if it's to do with British exceptionalism or kind of a mind frame thing that being in England is the best country. And obviously, it is the most or one of the most interesting leagues in the world. You know, I don't want to put that claim down. But in terms of it, you've raised a really good point there. Maybe Jadon Sancho would lead the light, but post this potential lockdown, because it's going to be two ways. Like, if Britain and Europe don't allow this between their FAs, I think this is a footballing matter, you know, and it will have to be sorted out like that. It could be like a young Brazilian player trying to enter into England. It just won't happen. And it's really, really sad. You know, they have to be truly, truly exceptional. I think there was like a joke that Arsenal, Man United, you know, all these big clubs were interested in Ronaldinho at the time, you know, when he was a young man. He went to PSG, but the opportunity was there. And he couldn't go to an English club because he hadn't made his international start. It's baffling that that happened, but it's the system. I hope there are loopholes. I hope that it does change. But at the moment, my voice of concern is from the fact that there is no guidance. There is no rules or plan in place. But as you said as well, it's a very uncertain time. So maybe they don't know how to plan.
This is it. I think this is a fascinating topic, and I'm sure you've got your opinions on it. Do get involved. Tweet us at Verulam Sports. Jason, I want to circle back for a second to the fact that you and I mutually agree. We kind of eulogize that in our heads, sports stars are entertainers, and as a consequence, earn every penny of that. Just want to kind of put the flip on that, not down the angle of, well, are they better paid or the inflated wages and this and that. I think that's churlish. But one thing I would like to get your take on is, in a long ago podcast, Graham Griffin made a point that he felt that the increased earnings of young footballers in the Premier League, oftentimes unproven, but just by dint of that's where they are and their market value accordingly, gives them a sense of obviously massive achievements, and they don't have any of the worries in life anymore. And accordingly, he suggested, his opinion, I'm sure it's held by many, that that curbed the hunger, the desire to become a true great, to really nurture that talent. I'd love your take on that. And I guess, does that chip away about our overarching view that indeed they are earning every penny? Is it the case that sometimes maybe every penny hasn't actually been earned yet?
Well, maybe linking as well to this discussion about Brexit, I think if things are not sorted out, we could see a lot of English youngsters on bumper contracts because they are the best in the land and they're such a fine art product. You know, we already see a, in air quotes, a not actual real, but a British tax on players. You know, somebody like Danny Drinkwater went for 30 million when if he was German or Italian, he probably would have gone for like 15, 10 million.
Yeah.
On the point of money earned versus those kind of players, I think you're going to see actually a growth in young players getting bumper contracts. And this is because of the nature of the economic system of football, that players will not be easily able to move during this financial fair play times, even though Man City have or have not, you know, reading into that case, maybe broke the rules and have not been punished, but I wouldn't like to give an opinion on that because I haven't sifted through the millions of pages on it. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of clubs are going to find it hard to do a Neymar, a Mbappe kind of transfer. And we've seen it recently with a player called João Felix. He went from Benfica to Atletico Madrid for 120 million. That is astonishing for an under 21 player. But we'll probably see it with Jadon Sancho, and we'll probably see it more often because it's going to be buying into potential now. And in terms of if it will deter players, I think the best of the best, the likes of Ronaldo, Messi, you know, Mbappe, Neymar, they're hungry from a young age, and they will be the best because they continue that hunger. It will be up to a club, and maybe they'll have to employ psychologists to measure whether these players can continue that. But again, kind of bring it back to our Brentford chat, that's one of the things that they kind of base it on, whether players have the right attitude. And we've seen it before, you know, players who haven't got a fantastic contract kind of give up the ghost because they're just disenchanted with the sport, other off-field things, you know, they might be dealing with family problems. There's an all multitude of reasons, but I think the hunger argument for me doesn't run because there's so many good young players that have this hunger. I think it's just down to the individual. I don't think it's necessarily money comes into it. I just think it's down to whether you want to be the best. And there's very...
I think that's a wonderful point. But also, I suppose when you've kind of, when you are that young, and we're talking specifically about, I guess, here, football in the Premier League, but it pans a lot of different sports. I think so much has to depend on who is in your entourage and what is your kind of family background and what kind of values you have. For instance, when the stars first joined the NFL, the American Football League, one of the first things that they are actually given is a whole program on how to comport yourself, how to deal with hangers-on, people coming out of the woodwork, expecting that now, yeah, I taught you how to throw, young, you know, who are you? Where have you come from? And they're given this kind of control because they've come from college into all of a sudden massive money out of nowhere. Okay, it must be a head trip. I don't care who you are. It's going to change your world. But if your world is surrounded by a yes men and hangers on and this, that, and the other, then it's going to be challenging to manage that transition. I know the Premier League are embracing certain similar programs, but we're at least a generation, maybe even two generations behind America in this regard. I think talking economics and sort of human development as well as athletic prowess, because they are humans, people, these sports stars, they are just, at the end of the day, they bleed like you and I, they have to do their business and this and that. They are human beings, and they have the pressures accordingly. But Jason, I'd like your take here on what extent do we need to do more to manage or help manage this transition into super affluence at a very, very young age from the Premier League stars' perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the fact that, you know, a previous guest that we had on was the only sports psychotherapist to a Premier League team. I think the absence of individual psychology, you know, actually helping people with their problems, is something that will really have to come into the Premier League. I think, you know, that they have a lot of sports psychologists, so how to be the best at what you're best at, but there's not a lot of psychological people in there who are thinking, all right, you're doing very well at the moment, but how are you feeling as an individual? And like you've rightly pointed out, for a young man who, young man or woman who suddenly comes into this amazing amount of money, they may have come from poverty, they may have seen this and that. It'll be such a big change that sometimes it might be too much for an individual. And I think that that is where the change needs to come in the culture of clubs, that searching for help for players is not a bad thing. And I think thankfully we're seeing this recently, you know, Prince William has done some great kind of programs, and the recent FA Cup was the Heads Up FA Cup, which is fantastic. You know, almost, I wouldn't say glorifying, but actually making it acceptable for sports people, men, women, whatever, to kind of go, you know, we're on the pitch, we're giving it our all, but off the pitch, we might be tender, we might need a cry, a hug, whatever, because we're all human, like you said, we all bleed. And I think that's where sport needs to change, football especially, that it needs to have a bit more compassion for the individual players. So that's probably something that I would give. And just adding to the point of people losing their inspiration young in the face of maybe too much money, I would also point to people like Tiger Woods, Muhammad Ali, Lewis Hamilton, who not only came up to be the best in their sport, but in the face of huge racism. And kind of one of the big things there that might put somebody off might be that they're racially abused. So again, a more compassionate sport where somebody takes them aside, somebody's been racially abused, and go, look, let's talk about this psychologically. That could be a big thing to save people's careers as well. So compassion is the main word there, Tony.
Absolutely. It's all about compassion and then finding the way to really apply compassion, because, you know, even the very word is misunderstood, I would argue. It has connotations of almost weakness. True compassion, you could argue, is a real strength. And I think that's something that we need to be more mindful of.
Totally.
But again, your views, all things sport and economics, it's such a vast topic. We're doing our best to unpack it, but I know you've got opinions. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Again, I'd love your views here on, are sports stars overpaid? Does that payment negate the hunger to be the best? Are we on a world where we can envisage a £1 billion player? Want to get your views? Tweet at Verulam Sport. Keep them coming. Jason, I want to get your take now on an important topic, because we're talking economics, and one of the drivers of that finances, of course, is fans, but also the spread, the global spread of the ability to engage with a global fan base, which of course is made possible through the media in traditional forms and these days across social media. Jason, I know you've got interesting views here. Enlighten us on your take on the potential streaming options, which may be the new world order from a sporting perspective in terms of their ability to engage with a global audience.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to talk about the potential for a Premier League TV package, basically. Will this be the end of Sky, BT Sport, you know, the traditional forms of media? And I think, you know, people, economists have looked into this, and we remember, you know, maybe with fondness, maybe not so much. 1992, there was that huge breakaway, and that was for reasons of money. Football League didn't want to engage in the riches of the new TV programme, and well, the Premier League club said, we're going to make our own league. Now, December 2019, this is one of the big inspirations for it. We saw the Premier League actually stream a load of games for the first time ever, totally online, and this was through Amazon Prime. But what a lot of economists are kind of reviewing and saying, that the Premier League could make a hell of a lot of money by cutting out that middleman of a streaming service, a TV service. Why do the Premier League now need a Sky, a BT with their pundits, whatever, when the Premier League could just go straight to the consumer? So kind of a little bit of a history here, but the first ever TV deal for the Premier League was $50 million. Now the latest one is an eye-watering $3 billion just for domestic and $1.4 billion for foreign rights. Now, I mentioned Sky and BT because they have 6 million customers who have the football packages at Sky, and BT have 2 million customers for their BT Sport. All in all, if you wanted to get Amazon, BT, Sky to watch as many as possible, because you don't see all the Premier League matches, but as many as possible, that would be £76 per month. That is astonishing. Now, a lot of these economists have said if you remove the middleman and went straight to the consumer, it would cost less for them and it would earn the Premier League so much more money. So the estimates now that the Premier League might actually earn a little bit less on the next TV deal, purely because of the economic circumstances, it won't be possible. But the estimates from TIFO Football is that actually the Premier League could earn not $3 billion, not $6 billion, $24 billion if they just charge people £12 per month. So £76 down to £12 per month. It would be called, you know, something like the whole Premier League TV package. Now, the problem would be the initial monetary investment, creating a Premier League production company, hiring pundits, equipment, etc., etc., and also kind of finding the right pundits, the right people for each country as well. But once you get over that, $24 billion, so each club would probably be getting about £1 billion instead of $300 million that they do at the moment. That is ridiculous. Now, Formula One, I think, are actually the first sport who are trying to attempt that. Now, at the moment, it does have a few problems. A lot of people have had streaming problems or signing up problems, but it looks like they're testing the water to see if they can move Formula One from the traditional media form. So it's called F1 TV. You go on there, you can pay per month or for the year, and what you get is, it would basically be kind of like saying it's an interactive app with data facts, but with documentaries, clips, exclusive
historical
kind of stuff.
Things like that. Okay. Yeah. So like, it's basically, it's a network. Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic thing. Maybe you could call it F1 Flicks, something like that. But at the moment, they're not showing the live races because, you know, they don't have the rights to. But what I'm thinking is the plan with F1, similar to what Sky might do in the future, is that they will have the pure rights, cut out the middleman, and potentially we might no longer see Sky Sports, BT Sports. It could be the end of an era. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but there are also potential problems. And I think you're going to tease this out, Tony, that it could also mean that Ferrari, Mercedes, all these big companies might, with this image right kind of thing, negotiate it that they can stream just their car. So you can only see Lewis Hamilton's car going around the track from his point of view, which could be problematic for the smaller people. So I don't know, what are your initial thoughts on that? $24 billion shared between the 20 of the Premier League, or is there a potential to actually damage the league irreparably forever.
One thing it would do would be to change the league. As to how it happens in reality, again, time will tell. As to whether it's desirable, again, that's an interesting question. What I will say is, I'm going to start with this, and I'm not really going to finish this point, maybe use it as a teaser for another day. I'm still a believer, and you and I have had these conversations in various houses of drinking, shall we say. But I believe, in much the same way that the era of the Premier League was an inevitability going back over a generation ago, I'm hugely convinced, and I've been so for many years, that there will be a Europa Supra League. And I think beyond that, there will eventually be a global Super League. But that's another generation removed. Already, this has gone from me kind of sounding like one of those kind of conspiracy theorist lunatics to the fact that just last season, lots of different clubs, I think Man City will reference Juventus and a few others, where the suits had been open about that this is something that they are working towards. Generally, it's not set in stone, it's still moot. But generally, when you have those suits coming out to talk about it, again, the wheels of inevitability are in place and the seeds are simply being sown, because that will change the world. And I have my own views on that. It's a long conversation, but I'd love your quick take on that, though, listening in. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. But coming back to the reason I brought that up really was because it's about era, an era definition. OK, and as I say, the Premier League era, there were those who hated it in its inception. Were like, really, oh, this is the death of football as we know it. And now there are those, Jason, I know you are still a relatively callow youth, relatively. And I know many of our listeners can't believe there was football before the Premier League. Is the point. But here's the thing, okay? I think the a notion of the kind of streaming, and as you say, on paper, it sounds nothing but utopia, whereby, again, people can go direct, cut out the middleman, okay, etc., etc. For a lesser amount, we make more money. Where's the problem? Well, here's where the problem could kick in. Sky and BT's money, say what you mind about it, it's irrelevant. That's not what we're debating now. What we're stating clearly is that Sky's money there, in terms of Premier League teams, is evenly distributed. Okay? That's why the playoff, where Brentford narrowly lost to Fulham, had Brentford won, it would have been netted them over 5 years, potentially £230 million, according to Deloitte. I think Fulham, because they had only just come down and go straight back, congratulations to them, it was, I think, initially £135 million, probably rising to about £160 million, according to best Deloitte estimations. The reason that is the most affluent game in all of sports isn't because you're going to get increased fan base. You're going to. It hasn't got anything really to do with merchandise. It might add in a little 0.1% of money here and there, maybe a few percentage points. Great. It's because of Sky's money. Right. And that's equally and evenly distributed. And Sky, yeah, there's Super Sunday. They have the big matches. But if you are a neutral or whatever, you're going to see your team consistently throughout the season at some point in time across Sky and BT output, which I think is important. Now, my concern in terms of this utopian vision that you've introduced with regards to the streaming side of things is that sadly, I could almost envisage a scenario where almost like we've mentioned in the past in Spain, for instance, where monetary flow TV-wise is essentially Barcelona and Real. And then people are wondering why they have such hedge money. Well, it's because they're controlling 98% of the capital just through their TV control. And it isn't that same kind of borderline meritocracy in what is a giant capitalistic scenario. So I'd be concerned about that. I would be fearful that the quote-unquote big four, you know, Man City, Liverpool, Man United, maybe, whatever it might be, certainly the top 10 teams would be able to monetize their streaming service in a much more savvy way, maybe a much more desirable way, and gain access accordingly to a much bigger chunk of the pot than they've already got access to at the moment. That's my concerns. Would never pitch myself as an expert on economic factors, but they are the reasons that I'd be dubious about anything. There's an old one. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And that's broken down there, you know, making massive savings, making more money. It just almost smells a little bit too good to be true to me, and I, for the concerns I've expressed. But yeah, Jason, please continue and elaborate or dissect.
Well, I would throw the question back to you then. If it remains in the current form, you know, as we've discussed here, it will be run by the Premier League, just in this scenario that I'm talking about, not the kind of hyper capitalist system where each team controls their own rights, which they don't in the UK. If it stays as the current system is, can you see a downside to actually Premier League TV streaming service? Because if the money is continued to be spread equally, if it cuts out this middleman, do you think that the only people that are going to lose out are the people at Sky? You know, that there could be job losses, but then potentially it could be like The Athletic, the new amazing kind of sports paper that has been, you know, taking the best talent from the BBC, other kind of outlets. Would it just be an assimilation of those with great talent to then come to this new Premier League thing? Is it just individuals at Sky that are going to lose out, really?
To be honest with you, in terms of the individuals at Sky, this and that, I care not a jot. I think it's life, you have to adapt and evolve, or, you know, you're a dinosaur almost. And I know often tongue-in-cheekedly, I refer to myself as a dinosaur. But the thing is, it isn't so much as the entity that provides it, but the fact that the current entity, at least in terms of Premier League flow of the money, does it remarkably fairly. It's an even share. And I can't anticipate, if you are entering this almost wild west of clubs able to negotiate packages and deals and stream and this and that, I just can't anticipate any world where the biggest don't continue to get bigger. And I know already we've got that, and I get it. There's leagues within leagues in the current model. It's far from perfect. Actually, that's why I advocate a European Super League. But for me, it's really a matter of, I can only envisage the richer getting richer and the poorer in a Wild West, a cowboy market, as opposed to, you know, I guess in many ways what I'm really saying is, it could well be, it's better the devil you know.
I think, though, if the structure stays in place, but then maybe I'm being too positive this there, because obviously the reality, the nature of it, is that teams will want to benefit themselves. What I've found interesting, though, is kind of the voting on such matters recently as the five substitutes, things like that. Clubs, especially at the top, do not want to vote on what the middle clubs want and the lower clubs want. So I can't remember specific rule changes, but recently there was one where middle teams like Wolves, Leicester, etc. wanted a slight rule change to allow things just to be a little bit more fair. But clubs like Chelsea, Man United, Arsenal, Liverpool, etc., you know, the ones at the top, the traditional power bases, not this season's kind of results in the table. I'm talking about the biggest clubs in England, voted against it, even if it was slightly against their own interests, because they don't want the smaller clubs to gain too much power. It's a really fascinating thing. And again, maybe this just backs up your point that at the end of the day, the big clubs are going to do what the big clubs are going to do. And the little minnows, until they can compete with the big clubs on finances and on the pitch, are just kind of there for the ride. You know, they're on the coattails of the fact that people want Man United. They want to see them every week and whoever they're playing. So I think it's a very interesting point. Maybe bring it on to Europa Super League. Could Premier League streaming service with smaller clubs, maybe potentially losing out, could that fasten that process that you kind of see in the future?
Like I say, for me, Jason, this is an inevitability now. In much the same way as a generation ago, the Premier League was an inevitability. Generations shift attitudes, mores, values. Every generation, there's a shift, and everything sort of shifts along with it. And thus, we got the Premier League. As I say, many people listening can't imagine life without the Premier League. Now, we've already had, as I say, the big suits no longer kind of being coy about this. I'm utterly convinced about this. I've been harping on about a Europa Super League for probably the best part of 20 years. Really, I have. And people thought I was absolutely stir crazy when I first started pontificating along these lines.
Take the tin hat off. I'm telling you
now for a fact, it is utterly inevitable. When suits come out, they're not hiding it away. They're not subtly, being nuanced about it or kind of planting seeds. They've come out. There are always lots of logistics to consider. Who makes the original mix, et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be winners and losers, right? But the nature of our world is getting more interconnected, you know? That's the reason why we have an iron brace, for instance, again, to use American football as an analog, the international series where, you know, the teams come to Wembley or Spurs' ground or whatever it might be, right? Sports global, for better or for worse, for economic reasons, for just the nature of our entertainment value, good, bad, we've debated it, you've got your views, tweet in. Point I'm making is, this Europa Super League is, as for me, it's you know, like they said in The Matrix, that is the sound of inevitability, right? Now, how I've always envisaged this working is almost like an American model, right? People said to me, oh, it'll be the death of domestic football. Only if you want it to be, right? So because we've already understood that the haves have and everybody else is just aspiring. And we'll come back to aspiration momentarily because I think it's a critical problem, right? But, you know, let's take a club who won't, for instance, be in the debate from an English point of view to be representing England in the European Super League, right? I don't know. Let's call it an Everton, for instance, right? Historically big club, moving to a new stadium, you know, what have you, right? If you're an Evertonian, if you're a real toughie, right? Even the most optimistic toughie, do you honestly, can you look me in the eyes now and say, you're going to win the league? Season 2021. I know there was a Leicester City aberration. Again, once a generation, we have these aberrations, right? But imagine, okay, and I'm not doing the, like, I'm not breaking it down into what the representatives of England are or would be or might be or whatever, yeah. But I would just have this European Super League where they have to, by the way, in my model, play X number, to be defined, number of English talent in the starting lineup, I would say, okay? And that applies in Italy. A friend of mine, by the way, talking diaspora, talking, you know, economics, massive, massive Juventus fan. And he was not in the least disappointed that Juve went out in the Champions League the other night. Not in the least. In fact, I wouldn't say he was happy, but he wasn't unhappy. The reason being is because at the end of the day, he's a second generation Italian. And I think when the full-time whistle went, they had one Italian qualified player on the pitch. And that's always been the kind of label that's been thrust at England, isn't it? You know, oh, too many foreigners. We've already talked about this tonight, right? But my point is, there should be in this European Super League X number of players who are of the home nation playing. You can have a squad as full of as many international stars as you like, you know? Now, I think it should work almost in the conference style like they have in American football. And they play out to almost a Super Bowl-esque winner and loser. Then here's where domestic football lives, right? We don't lose the Premier League. We might have to rebrand it, okay? But all of a sudden, an Everton, right, can aspire to win this league, right? They've also got to cultivate their talent and, you know, they can still attract other stars. And, you know, I would suggest that after a certain amount of time in this European Super League, there must be some model of relegation and promotion. So, for instance, if we had, I don't know, let's just use your Gunners, for example, right? In this European Super model for historical purposes, because obviously at the moment, Leicester City would say, well, Arsenal there, we won it league in like a few seasons back. I'm just using it as an illustration, right? Say Arsenal, hypothetically, in this European Super League is an English representative, however many teams there are, I don't know. and they just do poorly for, let's call it, three straight seasons, right? So, yeah, in this kind of, and it is hypothetical, but I'm utterly convinced, as I've said many times, that this is going to happen. Europa or Super League or something there, but they'll brand it something. Anyway, so imagine Everton win the rebranded Premier League or whatever, the domestic English League, three times. Let's call it three times. And I don't know, in a similar span, one of the English representatives in the Europa or Super League, could be an Arsenal, could be a Manchester United, whoever, come in the lower areas, the lower echelons, perform poorly, then there should be the ability for Everton in that context to gain access, to replace. And that applies across all of the tournaments. So there's a nominal number of teams from all the different nations, and there's going to have to be that initially banked, but there is the chance for everybody else in the domestic competitions to still gun for the Europa Super League after, I don't know, a nominal time. Like I called it 3 years, whatever it might be. And then, like I say, so you still got this natural flow where the best of the best, the elite, are going to be plying their trade, competing at the absolute highest standard. There's still, because of the possibility in my model of gaining access to it after a period of time, for that cherry, that dream, that drive to be there domestically. But again, on a domestic level, all the other teams all of a sudden can claim bona fide silverware. They, like I say, in Everton, just to give an example, Newcastle, for instance, all of a sudden, they would genuinely think if you're taking away the big four, so to speak, they would believe and they would fight and they would indeed have every chance of claiming domestic glory. So I still think in actuality, it won't be the death knell for domestic football, but actually globally it will be maybe the injection, exactly the kind of injection that, again, for many football fans listening can't believe it when I tell them there was football before the Premier League. And again, there was this fight, this anti-wave, but inevitability grabs. And once a generation, things move on. For me, economically, pragmatically, I've been banging this Europa Super League drum for over a generation myself. And I'm sure it's going to happen. And yeah, it's like your thoughts briefly on this.
It seems like maybe they should incorporate you on the board of directors here, because it sounds like something that you thrashed out, as you said, for many years. You put 20 years thought into it. I, for myself, don't like the idea. I know that you're very a proponent for it and maybe rejuvenate it. But I think, if anything, a TV deal like the one suggested might actually usurp this. If it can be done right, like we've said, you know, there's pros and cons. But I think if there's parity in the economics of these teams, and we've also seen it with the likes of Leicester. Yes, they're owned by a billionaire, but they work in a very kind of tight economic context so that they don't really spend more than they get in. And what they do, they look at data analytics, things like this. Brentford as well, Moneyball FC, is becoming more and more possible. And I think in many ways, there is a big gap at the top of the Premier League. I think Liverpool have done well because they've done the data analytics and used their amazing money. But I think we'll see in the next few seasons the fact that Wolves are up there, Sheffield United data analytics team, and broke the Premier League. You know, they came in, they didn't score a lot, but they defended so well, and that kind of broke people's minds. They're thinking, oh well, you don't need to score bundles of goals to do well in the Premier League. I hope that those stories continue, because for me, if teams are playing in a Europa Super League, I think it would undermine the value of domestic football. Like, yes, it's nice to win the Premier League, but it isn't the Europa Super League. And people will say that, and the Premier League would probably become like the Carabao Cup of domestic football. It's nice, but things like the FA Cup as well might become obsolete, because there's no point in winning it, because squads will so be concerned with that. And for me, that would be a great loss. But we're talking about, you know, diversification being there. And as you said a little bit earlier, Tony, you wouldn't feel sorry for people that didn't change with the new media movement. And maybe that's where I might get left behind because I'll be clinging on to the old style of football. It'd be interesting to see for sure, but I hope football doesn't move in that manner and that your prophecy might be wrong there for once, Tony. But let's move on to something else that you want to bring with the economics of sport here, because I've kind of covered my two here, but I'm fascinated with what you kind of want to bring it on to as well.
Well, all of this ties together, really. And again, always inviting you to keep involved with us. And thank you for this topic. Tweet us at Verum Sport, your views on everything addressed today, everything controversial we've analysed, all your thoughts on the force of economics in sport. Love to hear from you. Keep involved. Jason, my next economic force, again, we're keeping it on the football Premier League focus here, is I fear that almost the dream as it stands of the Premier League is economically crushing too many clubs. We've discussed that we love to romanticise the Moneyball teams, Sheffield United, etc., etc. They're beautiful and they give us hope. But so many big teams. Wigan Athletic were a Premier League team just a few short years ago. Now in administration. Bolton Wanderers, we talk about great imports. JJ Okocha, so good they named him twice. Bolton did wonders under Sam Allardyce, one of the oldest clubs in the football infrastructure, in administration. Leeds, of course, I'm over the moon that they are a Premier League force, but we saw them chasing not the Premier League dream, but the Champions League dream, as it were, and went into some type of administration that took them 16 years to get back to the promised land. My point is, really, and it isn't going to change any, but the economic driver of getting back to the big time, or at least trying to compete beyond your means, is crippling football. It's taking out these big teams. They're just off the top of my head. The list is very deep. And it is a deep concern for me, I'm sure many listening, is that it's all very well and good to have dreams, to aspire, but if that isn't well managed, if that is just crippling the clubs, then again, we talk about the sport as an entertainment industry and the fans that they represent, that they draw in, they are almost letting down those fans, because if they don't exist, then they're going to have to go to another team, aren't they? My concern is not economics per se, but overspending in pursuance of a dream. Quickly, your thoughts on this meta topic, I suppose.
My initial thoughts on it actually are, and it might be controversial, but I think my viewpoint on this is the pursuit of the Premier League should be paramount for a lot of these teams. And I feel that it's a bit of maybe Darwinianism. It's weeding out the weaker, poorly run teams. And I feel like it's a bit with some of the attitude of some of these clubs, institutionally, they just feel like they deserve to be in the Premier League. And they spend that way, and then it costs the team, the clubs, and it's heartbreaking. Because it's the management and maybe the ethos within the club which is costing players, fans, and the community. Whereas I would say, maybe harking back to a point that we both made, it's a bit of dinosaurism. They're thinking, we were in the Premier League, we're going to carry on the way that we were. And instead, it's kind of just a harsh reality wake-up call for a lot of these. You've cited Leeds, and I think Leeds, you know, were in the ethos of, we were fantastic in the 60s, 70s. We should be there, not we shall fight to prove ourselves or improve ourselves to be there. It was kind of like, it's a given, we'll get back, we'll spend our way out of this, and we'll make it, kicking the can down the lane. So I think the fact that clubs like Bournemouth, Huddersfield, Brentford, minuscule clubs, now two of those made it to the Premier League, one is on the edge, but they adapted, they changed to modern football and to exploit loopholes, you know, foibles, nuances in the system. So I think the problem is probably with the allowance of certain owners, the league, so that the Championship, League One, League Two, make a promise to do the right and proper test for owners, and they don't. So I think it's a little bit of a failure on the league and a failure on clubs institutionally to change. But maybe you can change my point, Tony, but sometimes I feel that it's a problem. But my sympathy goes for fans, players and people that miss out because of mismanagement. You know, we see it at the top level as well. But what are you going to enlighten me on, Tony?
No, I think you've really broken that down quite nicely. And as you say, it's the sufferers, the real losers are the guys who ultimately do, you know, partially pay the wages. I mean, we do talk about the importance of money from TV sources, whatever that source might be. But at the end of the day, it's still the fan who pays their season ticket to, you know, their heart and soul goes into the club and their money as well. Who are the losers when Bolton are in administration, when Wigan are in administration, et cetera, et cetera. But there is this mismanagement question. I think you've identified that very neatly. But for me, it is a concern because it's almost becoming endemic. We talk about a pandemic that we're all experiencing at the moment, but there will be so many other big teams. And, you know, another concern is, again, where the money comes from. And we spoke earlier on about the ins and outs, without going too deeply into it, of Man City being found not guilty, it would seem, so of financial fair play. My point is, though, it is a precarious situation that all football teams face. Even, for instance, Chelsea. If Abramovich tomorrow moves on, then they are not in a healthy financial situation. Man City, again, bankrolled. I know they've got much better infrastructure. They've taken a little bit more of a bigger picture perspective. But at the end of the day, they would still have to find that hit. It would be a massive hit. And this is the danger, I think, that, again, I look at the Leeds situation, and you did reference their big eras in that earlier period of time, the 60s and the 70s. But really what caused their demise up until the now return to grace in the next season in the Premier League was, again, poor management at the very highest. But Ridsdale, at the time chairman, was chasing the dream because they were semi-finalists, losing narrowly to Valencia in the Champions League. They then got back to the Champions League the following season. So his kind of economic squandering and poor management was kind of justifiable, at least predicated on the illusion of two great years. And, you know, again, we're talking about the economics and the fan. We've already, and it's much documented, discussed Arsenal's expensive season tickets relative to the other teams in the league, which I guess could be a pill that a Gunner could swallow when you were consistently in the Champions League, when you were, you know, maybe granted underachieving there, but still at least you were witnessing the greatest in Europe coming to the ground and going out to these great venues. So you could kind of understand it. And again, you know, I think Arsenal will be fine. I think most teams will be. But that's a financial model that is predicated. It's always based on assumptions. And the assumption is a continuation of success. Or in the case of some of these other teams that we've referenced, it's on the assumption or the hope that if we spend big, we will succeed, we will climb up the leagues, and then we'll be a force, and then we'll get the Sky money, etc., etc. And this is the danger. And again, I appreciate the Darwinian take, but it's infinitely more nuanced, because even at that uber elite level, at the, you know, the sort of the super sharks, okay, the super predators, the big four, right? Granted, Man United's a brand, yeah? But if tomorrow, you know, people moved away and, you know, there was a stock market crash and, you know, this and that, it's an illusion. And this is a deep concern. It's both economic and societal. Always these things go hand in glove. But yeah, that is my, I guess, take on your valid points, that it isn't as brute as just bad management. Sometimes there are underlying cultural assumptions that lead to bad management. And that is the matter, as far as I can see.
Yeah, I think I'm agreeing you with it to an extent there, because I'm saying about the ethoses that won't change in clubs. But what I would say is I look at a lot of these clubs and I do lay the blame on the upper management. And it is the spend right ethos. You know, if you look at certain clubs, they spend big, but not right. I think there's a manager merry-go-round that we've seen in the Premier League, yep, of really poor managers, but constantly rehired because, oh, well, it's Mark Hughes. You know, Hughesy's a good bloke. He used to be good at Man United. And I don't want to pick on him individually, but it's an endemic problem. But what I would say is kind of comparison to what we said earlier is the right context of football. It's an entertainment industry. If a film or a TV series suddenly turned downhill or was really bad, you wouldn't feel sorry for them. You'd feel sorry for maybe the individuals, you know, the background people that would lose their jobs at a company. But you would lay the blame firmly and say there's a culture or something has gone wrong that they've chosen a film there to make that was just really bad. So I think if films perform poorly, just like clubs, people don't feel sorry for the films or the clubs. They should, you know, be angry that they'd be mismanaged. And I think, yes, there's a goal to get to the Premier League, but that's good. You know, I don't think that aspiration should be frowned upon. I mean, in this sense, we're kind of mollycoddling mediocrity. We're kind of saying, oh, well, people should, you know, just be happy where they are in the Championship. But I think you have to be aspirational within certain aspects of positive thinking. You know, you have to do it in a manageable way. But I don't think that you should move away from that. I think, you know, we've discussed this with people from local clubs where they talk about the teams actually, we don't want to get promoted because we're worried about higher wages. But why not? Like, the higher wages, yes, but then you'll be earning more from revenue. I think it's a very poor attitude. And to kind of say that the Premier League is at blame here, I think it's more down at the lower level here that it's a problem with people at clubs just not managing things properly. If it was a company or anything else, you'd just be mad at the company for letting its workers down.
Well, again, it's totally in concurrence with you there. As always, inviting you to get involved with this thorny matter of the economics of sport and its impact, and both positive and negative. I'd love to hear from you. Keep involved. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Now, just shifting things, but kind of in line with what we've just been analysing there. We speak about earlier tonight the need for equality of opportunity. I think in life, realistically, that's all anybody can actually wish for. I think if you've got an equal chance and you know that, what more can you want? You're happy. You commit to your goal knowing that at least you've got every opportunity. Now, I think one of the reasons underlying people's animosity towards sports and wages is actually a misunderstanding of who the villain in the piece is. And for me, my major issue isn't, as we've already analysed, with the individual players earning as much as they rightly due, in my opinion. But actually, I think the real issue here is the flow of money down, because it's the grassroots that will create the superstars. That's the synthesis, that's the synergy between the entertainment and its next generation. And then beyond that, that cycle will always continue. But I don't think that any sport, and I think football is a big offender here, but I don't think it's the sole offender. I don't think sport really does enough to spread money, whether that comes purely through fan income, through the turnstiles or the stadia, through the media, whatever the whatever the source of the economics is, whether it's from big backers, whatever, my opinion, and it is a generalization, at the moment, nobody is totally guilt-free of being fair in how this economics flows from the tip of the iceberg down to its very, very grassroots. And I think it's that issue, actually, that many people miss when they blame players and think players are greedy and this and that. Jason, love your take on this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of classic trickle-down economics there, right there, that they should be embracing. I mean, for the point of it, I'm not sure where, and you might get onto this, Tony, but where the owner should lie in terms of who is going to spread that money. But for me, one of the biggest culprits, and I'm talking about football here again, I'm sorry to people listening if you want to hear about rugby or whatever, but Tony is better at that because football is what I know best about. That's what I'm good with. And I just look at an organisation like the PFA, you know, mm-hmm. Players Football Association. In loose terms, it's basically a footballers union, and it was used like that many years ago. Now, we're talking pre-football, pre-92, they successfully organised for the removal of the cap on players' wages. But nowadays, players have to kind of pay into this Players Football Association. Their coffers are stuffed to the hill, you know. Their mouths would be stuffed with gold, you know, something that Bevan would say. And it kind of worries me, sickens me a little bit, the fact that they don't help players out like a union, an organisation should. We've kind of seen this with head injuries, concussions. Mm-hmm. They don't pay out for that. But also the grassroots football. The fact that they've got hundreds of millions of pounds, they're sitting there to help develop small clubs, pitches, whatever. There should be an application process, grants given by the PFA, and also protection given by the PFA to certain clubs. I think that's where a big, big problem is. The fact that this money's being hoarded by organisations that were principally set up to protect, and now I don't know what they're doing with this money, and that'd be nice to see an audit on it, but they're just basically resting on their laurels. So that's one that I would point to. There's a big trickle-down effect waiting to happen there. But is there anywhere else, Tony, in football and in other sports where you could say this is what needs to happen to make it fairer?
Again, I think it's such a good point, and each and every single sport is going to kind of be unique. Taking it up a stage, if you can recall when we were speaking to World Cup winner Chris Wokes, Cricket World Cup star, I asked him the last question. So why do you think it is that England in football, speaking to a World Cup winner in cricket, haven't won anything since 66? And do check out the Chris Wokes interview. He's a really cool guy. It's available on podcast. But his point was dead simple. In cricket, and also in rugby to a certain degree, slightly more nuanced degree, essentially, the top players, England, their wages are paid not by the clubs, but essentially by the ECB, if you're in a cricket context, right? And his point, coming back to maybe another question we've addressed here tonight about appetite, desire, wanting to win. At the end of the day, it is the Premier League players who are playing for a club, many of whom, you know, as much as we've agreed that they deserve and earn every single penny, many of whom are mercenaries. I will never forgive, for instance, Alan Smith kissing the badge of Leeds United 1 week, the next minute he's a Red Devil. Go figure. How does that work? But dead simple point, in football and in rugby, it is the elite players whose money is controlled and flows from the boards, the ECB and the RFU, slightly more nuanced to rugby. And I think that is a good model. I don't think it could ever be modelled and replicated in football because of, again, apples, pears, different cultures, long conversations. But I think that's important. But culturally, there is so many issues. And I just think that all sports needs to address, and I like your word, because transparency is key. People can understand where they are when they know where everything's at. And I just think that, you know, there is such a concern there. Look, again, from a different angle, but from the same perspective of the elite of the elite. Again, another guy we've been lucky to interview several times, St. Albans' own badminton star. Won the bronze medal, first time in the men's doubles at the Rio Olympics. And, you know, was an unexpected bronze. You'd think, goodness me, he's overachieved there. He's going to be rewarded, right? Well, no. It was obviously already pre-agreed that badminton was no longer going to receive lottery funding. And so the poor guy has gone from, you know, achieving history in a little slice of history, and instead of being rewarded, has actually been punished. And now has to kind of, you know, seek sponsorship, do whatever he's got to do to maintain that ability to, you know, hopefully get back to the Tokyo Games, postponed as it's been. So, you know, again, it's so, so wide and varied, and so many decisions are pre-made. And this is the concern. And for me, it's just my tuppence. I honestly think that a lot of this is short-sighted and doesn't and lacks a bigger vision. I think there's an awful lot of tokenism. I think there's an awful lot of tokenism where there might be a program, and then that program is given a big PR stunt, and the PFA can pat themselves on the back. But they've not been transparent. That program is then finished, and what's the follow through? Where's the commitment? Where's the consistency? And these are my concerns. And they're massive, they're wide, and they're varied. And we could dissect it until the proverbial cows rock up at our doors. And I don't have the answers, but I do believe that one of the keys is that all sports from the very, very, very highest echelon have a program in place where they are transparent about the current overall economic state of their sport, their vision for where they are taking that sport in, let's call it a generation, 25 years, a bigger picture, and then how they are working towards that. They should be held responsible for those implementation of these projects. And that, culturally, I think, needs to happen. But here's the thing, Jason. It doesn't happen in any other walk of life. It doesn't happen in banking. It doesn't happen in, education. Our mistrust of success in many different forms has come from the fact that there is, I feel, a total lack of transparency, economically speaking. And sport, football, cricket, golf, tennis, the whole array of it, Olympics, is tarnished. And yeah, that's my take on it. I don't know if you've got anything further to contribute there.
I mean, what I would say is that no other industry does it, but maybe they should, you know. But it could be, again, an apples and pears comparison to the fact that sport is probably a bit more of something that you have to think in the future for because of the realities of the economic situations of it. You know, it's a bit comparable to, say, the BBC as an institution. A lot of these sports, especially at the Olympics, are niche. You know, badminton is a great sport. I totally respect them, but not a lot of people tune in to watch it. Curling, for example, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
These are things that, unfortunately, are not very watched. And it comes into the question of where do people have to step in and at what level, you know? How much does the lottery, the government, all these things, and, you know, we're not going to get into politics here, but economically speaking, of those kind of organisations, probably with more niche sports, they can't actually invest too much because they're limited. When it comes to football, though, there is clear kind of problems. But maybe, again, because I don't know more about those sports, I can't kind of comment and say definitely they've not got enough money to be able to do schemes at grassroots level. But what I can see from football, and probably rugby as well, is that they can invest more, but they choose not to for certain reasons, whether it be personal economic gain. I can't make those accusations because I've got no evidence for it. But there is definite problems, and I think it does need to be addressed. I think that's something that I totally agree with. And it has to start with these organisations that build themselves up with tokenism, you know, the PFA or others like it, going, oh, we're doing this scheme for these certain individuals. It's all right. It's a scheme. Normally, it's the community that have to pay into the scheme and then it's spread out, rather than the PFA kind of dipping into their money and going, this is what people pay in for and we're paying out. It just seems a real shame that not a lot is done. One other thing as well, Tony, maybe it's a point to end on to thrash out, but does England need a national stadium with Wembley? A lot of people have said if England sold Wembley as a stadium, they'd have loads of money to put into grassroots football. Now, is that a moot point? Is it a bit of a red herring, the fact that there is money there and the FA doesn't want to put it in? Or, like other countries, Spain, Germany, they don't have a set home venue. They play all around the country, and arguably, that kind of brings football around. Is Wembley a vanity project that maybe needs to be handed over to other things as well, a club or a community maybe to buy it? I think that's a very legitimate question as well to help out grassroots football in England.
Absolutely. And I tell you what, from a rugby perspective, Twickenham is hemorrhaging cash at this moment in time. And, you know, it's the case that the RFU have actually laid off at least 40%. I think it may have been actually 50% of their staff, gone out of a state of furlough to literally, you know, your services aren't needed at this time. And again, that is because the stadium there is, you know, it costs a fortune to maintain. It is the home base, of course, the spiritual home. But yeah, I think as we enter into a quote unquote new norm, certain conventions, certain traditions need to be questioned. They need to be severely questioned. And there is something to be said, I think, for, you know, a road trip style of a national team in all sports, maybe. But it's a very good point. I'd love, as always, to get your views. So keep them coming. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Quickly, and to wrap things up, we've obviously kind of discussed the economics of myriads of sports. We obviously have given it a bit of a football emphasis for understandable reasons. But as I mentioned there, the RFU, rugby indeed being the second biggest sport in this country, spectator-wise, et cetera, had to lay off a load of staff. We spoke about, from football's perspective, you know, these clubs going into administration. We get it. But football, barring something infinitely more intense than even what we're experiencing at this present time, will be fine. It's just got such a slew of money, whether that's from foreign investors or the media or this or that. It's got so much capital to play with. It will be sustainable. But my concern, as you've referenced, is these niche sports. Even if rugby is having to make people, you know, suffer, rugby league had to get government support. Obviously, that's quite a niche sport in and of itself. A great podcast, again, worth checking out, was with Kat Ratnapala from our own Saracens Mavericks netball team, who are looking and need, because of our global scenario now, £50,000. Their season's been wiped out. That means they've lost all their potential earnings. And again, this isn't bankrolled by a sheik from far off lands. So my concern isn't actually for football. I have concerns about the economics of football, as we've discussed. But I think the beautiful game is here to stay and will always be. I think rugby's got enough that, okay, the RFU have had to make a few tough choices, and that's obviously tragic. Cricket again. But while we love these sports, we love all sports. And my concern at this moment of time, economically speaking and practically speaking, is for those smaller, niche, but ever so loved sports. Jason, again, we interviewed Kat Ranapal. I'm sure you heard that one. Your thoughts on the economic danger of so many sports at this present moment in time?
Yeah, it's very concerning. And I was thinking that at the start of this coronavirus epidemic, that will we see the end of certain sports? I mean, probably post-corona, when things are more normal, they will come back in certain areas in different guises. But the reality is that there's probably lots of sporting clubs, like businesses, that have already closed their doors. And it's a real tragedy. It's no fault of their own. And I don't know what the answer is to that. Should there be a collective sport fund between, you know, maybe the richer ones, like the Premier League, rugby, cricket, kind of combined together, and maybe the British Sport Fund? I don't know, something like that would be fantastic to see, because there's great stories in football, like Bayern Munich financially bailing out Dortmund, their sworn enemies. But in tragedy, in moments like this, you see wonderful human moments where people come together and transcend sport, rivalry, whatever. And I think that's probably what we need at the moment. I don't know if it should be government-led. Again, we don't want to get into politics here, because that's not what we're about. We're about sport. But there's got to be some sort of leadership here on the issue, maybe from the sports appealing to other sports. Like I said, they're a great British sport fund. I don't know where it's going to come from, but something drastically needs to be done, because we've got other problems in this country, like obesity. And if we have less sports for people to kind of engage with, then, you know, logically speaking, probably there will be a higher amount of people, those overweight. So it could have huge repercussions, as we talked about at the start of the show, a butterfly effect, that if certain sports become so niche and so out there that they become nothing at all, that could really harm a lot of people in the country. Do you have like a resolution to this, Tony, or is there a positive lining to this? I'm trying to find one, because I don't want to end too sad.
I tell you what, it's my problem generally is that I'm very good at deconstructing, but I've spent many years pondering, and I haven't yet come to a way to positively improve things. Because what the horrible situation that we're living through at the moment has done is brought into sharp focus is just how transitory things are. And I think in many ways that's a positive thing. In many ways, I think this has been a very positive conversation. But we here on Verum Sports do not have all the answers. I'm sure at home you do. I know you're an absolute genius, getting set the world to rights, and you know it all. Come on, give us your clues, give us some ideas. Love to hear from you. Tweet at Verum Sports. I'm going to leave you with this, though, Jason. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you. Have I ever told you about my theory that I concocted, and I am inserting tongue firmly into cheek here, around about the time of the last economic crisis, the last recession of 08-09, that I refer to as at the end of the day fund?
No, I have not heard about this. I'm dying to hear. We don't have our pub anymore to go to, so this is the next best thing.
Well, look, this is tongue firmly, firmly placed in cheek. But maybe this could help, and maybe it should be mandated that this does get spread across all the niche sports or what have you. But I'm sure, you know, look, we're guilty of it as broadcasters and pundits. We use cliches and idioms all the time. I'd like to think that we are reasonably well-spoken individuals and with a reasonably strong vocabulary. But, you know, even you and I do adopt cliche from time to time. However, I wouldn't even begin to speculate. How many times do you think, love to get your suggestions on this, but just listening, at any given weekend, on circling to football, how many times across all broadcasts do you think you will hear a footballer utter the cliche or the idiom, the phrase, at the end of the day?
probably in the hundreds. You know, football cliches are memes within themselves. So I think I know where you're going with this. This is genius.
Absolutely. I think you've got it. I can see it's the penny drop. And again, Tog eminently firmly in cheek here. So what I'll possibly postulate as a way to spread the love. And again, coming back 360, I do not begrudge any footballer, any sporting star, any single penny that they've got. I truly don't. But they've got a fair few pennies, it is, I think, fair to say. So I would almost say it's like way back when in the Middle Ages, there was a tax on, you know, glass, because it was only the super privileged who could afford glass. So, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to tax those, you need more money. You can't tax people who've got no money. You're going to have to tax those who've got loads. So that's what they did. So this is, again, my little thought that occurred to me about, you know, a decade or so ago, was an at the end of the day tax. So for each utterance of that phrase only, like you say, there's so many at the end of the day, me and the boys and what have you, there's so many of them, but just at the end of the day, because for some reason, it's the one that irks me the most or the one that the most stands out. Each and every time a footballer in the Premier League, let's keep it to the Premier League, utters that phrase post-match, then they should be fined, taxed if you would, I don't know, call it £1,000, right? Say that was, as you say, in the ballpark of 100 times. Okay, per week. Well, one or two things is going to happen. Both of them could be really cool. Again, this is just me being a little bit silly, just a silly theory, very, very tongue-in-cheeked. Well, either that flow goes straight back into wider sport and grassroots, et cetera, great. Or lots of footballers are going to start, I don't know, learning another phrase, you know, and maybe applying an adverb like ultimately or just whatever it might be. And that's not necessarily a bad thing either. So, yeah, that's my little theory. Not the solution by any means, just a little thought that occurred to me in our last great recession, a way maybe our Premier League stars can give back, economically speaking.
Oh, I love that. The end of the day fund. I think you might be seeing plenty of thesauruses making up trophy cabinets in players' houses as well. And, you know, buying into the end of the day thing. At the end of the day, whatever helps, helps.
Absolutely. And at the end of the day, it's the end of our wonderful debate on sports and economics. Of course, it's such a big topic. And thank you very much indeed. As always, it's your show every bit as much as it is ours. And thanks again for providing that for us. We'll be back on 92.6 FM, 6 through 7, next week with another sporting debate of your choosing. Plus, there's going to be a whole heap of regular podcasts. We are committed to that now and loving it too. So for me, Tony Rice, the machine, Jason McKenna, always a pleasure to enjoy your company. And you for listening. Thank you massively. Keep well, keep safe, keep involved. All the best.